This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thanks to everybody for coming out, and thanks especially to Aaron for organizing this event, also to Jean-Michel and Slot generally for having this event. We've had a conference during the day today called Gender, Sexuality, and Modernism, sort of mostly organized through the English department at Penn, and this is both a sort of continuation of it, but also a departure from it, and we're just very grateful to be working with Slot on this. So I just wanted to say a couple words about sort of the conference, which is, we just had a really, I think, very exciting day of talks with a lot of provocations and really fruitful discussions, mainly, if I can sum up a full day's events, but mainly about the relation between issues of representation, feeling, ethics, and politics, and how we as literary and cultural critics respond to and influence that set of issues. And so I think it's really fitting in a lot of ways that we end the night with a session that engages the work of Tim Dean, who's done so much to explore the relationship between aesthetics and ethics, and to think about, in really exciting new ways, the relation between the psychic and the social. I guess Tim's done more than to explore this nexus. In Beyond Sexuality from 2000, he really deeply challenged common sense conceptions. Yeah, get that sucker off the screen. yeah, but he has to. he's really challenged, I think, you know, sort of common sense or sort of commonplace notions about how the psychic and the social might be related. And he's really, I teach in the and work in the primarily in the field of queer studies, and his work has just been a tremendous provocation in the best sense. So I'm very excited he's here tonight to introduce him more formally. Tim Dean is the author of Beyond Sexuality, as I just mentioned, and also the co-editor of Homosexuality and Psychoanalysis, which has also been a really influential and off-cited book in the field. It's sort of strange to think that it only came out in 2001, because it's really had an impact. His presentation tonight draws on research for his book, Unlimited Intimacy, Reflections on the Subculture of Barebacking, and that's forthcoming at University of Chicago Press. So Tim's going to start us off tonight. This is a sort of a panel and a roundtable. We're going to have a couple respondents. So I'm also going to go ahead and introduce Robert Casario and Jean-Michel Robité briefly, and then I'll pass things over to Tim. So Robert Casario, who was also, along with Tim, a panelist today at Gender, Sexuality, Modernism, is professor of English and head of English at Pennsylvania State. His publications include Plot, Story, and the Novel, From Dickinson and Poe to the Modern Period, and The Novel in England, 1900 to 1950, History and Theory, from 1999, and also just a huge number of very influential articles. His most recent work on gay and lesbian literature is Queer Fiction, The Ambiguous Emergence of a Genre, and Blackwell's Concise Companion to Contemporary British Fiction. He's currently work on Citizen Queen, a study of Paul Goodman, Gore Vidal, and Samuel Delaney. I also want to introduce Jean-Michel Robité, although I realize in some senses that isn't totally necessary at this audience. He's known to many of you. Jean-Michel has written and edited a staggering number of books on topics including Jacques Lacan in America and in France, modernity, psychoanalysis, literary theory, Ezra Pound, James Joyce, Samuel Beckett, Roland Barthes, Thomas Bernhard, and really the list is kind of goes on forever, so I'm just going to stop there. But most of us at Penn know Jean-Michel as an inspiring and valuable colleague. His active presence at Slot only begins to suggest the many ways that he has been present at Penn and in the community, and the many ways that he's sort of put us at Penn into dialogue with a wider world. So I'm really happy to be here at Slot tonight. So I'm going to pass it over to Tim now.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm concerned that people are having to stand up, that no matter what I say, you will get tired anyway. So, I mean, there is some very comfortable floor over here if you want to come and sit down, if anybody, and there's also, like, space around here that people can sit. It's the floor. Unless you persuade maybe one of my student Mary, you could maybe you could persuade someone to sit in their lap, but otherwise it's the floor. I wanted to thank Aaron and Jean-Michel for this invitation. We are going to screen, at Aaron's insistence, a couple of clips from the films I'm going to talk about. Given that fact, it seemed important to have a little bit of context for what you're going to see. So the paper I'm going to give you is a sort of providing some context for that. This paper is drawn from a book I recently completed called Unlimited Intimacy, which describes the emergence of a subculture of barebacking among gay men and provides an informal ethnography of the subculture, including its particular brand of pornography. Barebacking refers to anal sex without a condom, and the term derives from equestrian pursuits, riding a horse bareback without a saddle. Within the gay community of the United States, there now exists something called the bareback community, a notion that was unthinkable a decade ago. What has changed dramatically over the past several years is gay men's attitude toward condom use and HIV, such that the practice of risky sex and even the deliberate transmission of the virus that leads to AIDS have become the basis for new sexual identities and for community formation. Sexual risk, that is to say, has become organized and deliberate rather than merely accidental. Can you hear me at the back? Okay. You sure? Okay. As a sexually transmitted virus, HIV has had enormous impact on the development of pornographic conventions. Indeed, the history of porn has become intertwined inextricably with the history of AIDS. To begin with, the video revolution of the 1980s, when porn moved out of the theater and into the home, coincided with the discovery that the causal agent of AIDS is a blood-borne virus. One result of this coincidence was that during the 80s, a significant proportion of gay men stopped having sex with other people for fear of AIDS and reorganized their erotic lives exclusively or primarily around pornography. Jerking off to porn is the safest sex of all. For this and other reasons, porn consumption has become fully normative in gay culture and gay relationships in a way that it isn't yet in heterosexual culture or straight relationships. By about 1984, it became widely known that unprotected anal sex represents the most effective sexual means for transmitting the virus, not as effective as injecting it directly into your bloodstream by sharing needles, but fairly effective nonetheless. Slowly, gay porn producers started using condoms for scenes of butt-fucking, though only after a lot of porn stars had died from AIDS. It turned out that one of film pornography's central conventions, the so-called money shot, has prophylactic as well as cinematic value. I'm referring to the moment that has come to be understood as the narrative climax of a standard porn scene. And I'll describe this for you, but I'm sure you're familiar with what I'm talking about. When the guy who is fucking pulls out his penis and ejaculates onto the body of his partner. This convention predominates in both straight and gay mainstream porn, in case you didn't know. The practice of withdrawal before ejaculation was adapted as a safer sex technique when external ejaculation came to be understood as safer than coming inside. Quote unquote, on me, not in me, emerged as a safer sex catchphrase during the 80s. And when I was a boy in college, I remember this was the first safe sex education thing I heard. On me, not in me. This is what was kind of drummed into one's head. In the gay porn industry, condom use gradually became the norm throughout the 1990s, with external ejaculation, the money shot, retained as a desirable visual convention rather than for prophylactic purposes. In 90s gay porn, condoms represented not only an instance of safer sex, the actors protecting themselves and each other, but also a model of safer sex based on the belief that people tend to imitate what they see in pornography. The assumption that porn functions pedagogically, that it teaches people how to have sex, raises a host of questions that for now I wish to defer. Not completely, but just for now. It is certainly the case that porn functions differently for gay men than for straight men, owing to the comparative dearth of positive cultural representations of gay sexuality. In a homophobic world, gay porn is one of the few places where physical love between men is celebrated rather than condemned. Given this context, condom use in gay porn has tended to be viewed in terms of role modeling. If those unattainable stars on the screen wear rubbers when fucking, then I should do so too. Gay men's practice of safer sex thus is premised on rudimentary ideas about identification. I find it fascinating how pornography seems to disable the sophisticated theories of representation, fantasy, and spectatorship through which we understand other genres of film and media. It is as if the unmediated contact portrayed in porn and its often visceral impact on the viewer enabled us to forget that pornography, no matter how graphic, is a complex form of representation, a mediation of the real rather than the thing in itself. The recent emergence of bareback porn, in which deliberately unsafe sex among men is portrayed without apology, makes it especially important to think about pornography as a complex form of representation. When, in the late 90s, a couple of independent gay porn producers in California, I'm thinking of Treasure Island Media and Dick Wad Media, started making videos that focused on unprotected anal sex and explicit semen ingestion, the gay community, including other gay porn studios, reacted with outrage. It is one thing for two HIV-positive men to make the decision to fuck without condoms, but quite another thing to market such imagery as pornography, the argument went, because doing so glamorizes representations of unsafe sex. After a decade of watching movies in which the condom code was rigorously observed, it came as a genuine shock to see images of semen leaking from a man's butthole. Here I want to focus on the scene that opens in a notorious bareback video called Breed Me, made by avant-garde gay pornographer Paul Morris and released by his studio, Treasure Island Media, in 1999. Without warning, the screen is filled with a close-up of a pale, hairy ass being worked by a dildo with one hand, while the other hand holds a blue measuring cup that collects the remarkable volume of semen emerging from the guy's butt. After about 3 long minutes of this footage, and it can seem a long 3 minutes, depending on your tastes, my boyfriend just cannot watch it. No amount of money can persuade him to watch this scene. The movie cuts to a close-up of the measuring cup, which contains what looks like at least a dozen, perhaps as many as 20, loads of ejaculate. We are not accustomed to viewing close-ups of bodily fluids emerging from the anus, nor are we used to seeing such an accumulation of seminal fluid in one place. With its harsh lighting, minimal production values, and the untanned, untrimmed, stretched-out butthole, this scene has an amateurish, anti-aesthetic quality. But in terms of the history of AIDS, the scene is extraordinary. Gay men watching it realized that they were witnessing the most dramatic visual evidence of unsafe sex ever presented in the history of the epidemic. This helps account for the fact that Breed Me became the top-renting porn video in San Francisco's Castro district in April 2000. And that scene is one of the scenes we're going to screen after the talk, just so you're ready for it. I know you can hardly wait. The reverse ejaculation that begins this movie is graphically unmistakable, yet it comes out of nowhere, with no mise-en-scène or even minimal narrative context. The scene thus may be understood as traumatic, since the audience is unprepared for such an image, you now actually are, and cannot escape the impression that it is witnessing the violation of a taboo. The scene does not present an aesthetically pleasing or even a conventionally sexy image. Instead, it is meant to disturb, and its abrupt appearance contributes to the disturbing effect. German film theorist Gertrude Koch I'm never quite sure how to pronounce that to somehow circumvent that response. I clearly still not figured it out. This German film theorist, I'll call her Gertrude, characterizing the function of pornographic imagery, notes that, quote, only through the image can the observer confront that which would otherwise frighten him. Her comment helps explain the popularity of the film Breed Me at this historical moment, since many of those wishing to view such imagery would not necessarily have wanted to be in the position of the man whose reverse ejaculation they're witnessing. We might say that this scene inhibits identification rather than soliciting it. Breed Me offers an image that is calculated to arouse the viewer, though with considerable ambiguity about what sensations this audience is meant to experience. Part of what's represented in bareback porn is a culture of sexual risk that by 1999 was already highly organized. The assumption that pornography influences its viewers' behavior fails to explain the emergence of bareback subculture, since if gay men had been conditioned by gay porn during the 1990s, they never would have invented the discourse and practice of barebacking in the first place. The relationship between pornography and its audience's sexual activities therefore must be considerably more complex than a mimetic or behaviorist model of pornographic representation allows. Feminist and queer defenses of pornography tend to appeal to the category of fantasy when describing the unpredictable effects of behavior on any sexually explicit representation. Porn provides material for erotic fantasy, the argument goes, not a prescription for sexual behavior. Given the terms of these debates about pornography, I find it striking that the most articulate defense of bareback porn appeals not to fantasy, but to its ostensible opposite, documentary realism. Politically progressive defenses of porn have labored hard to dissociate it from the literalist assumptions of the documentary genre. This bareback pornographer Paul Morris is swimming against the tide, and he knows it, when he makes the case for his porn as documentary. Arguing in his very interesting manifesto that he feels a moral imperative to document sexual variation, Morris explains, quote, "I think it's a job of porn to reflect the experience and the character of the people who watch it. Since danger and risk are so much a part of the sexual experience, it's necessary that dangerous activities be represented, and that the danger be at least occasionally real and shocking. All acts of queer sex should be represented on screen with equal honesty. The entire spectrum of behavior, from innocent to depraved, from life-affirming to death-enhancing, should be available for the viewers." That's the end of the quotation. Morris conceives of what he's doing as documenting a sexual subculture, representing that subculture to and for itself. For the past decade or so, he has been conducting interviews with men about their sexual practices and recording the results, sometimes, though not always, on film. We might say that Morris is an ethnographer of San Francisco's sexual subculture as much as he's a pornographer, and hence his interest for my ethnographic project. If we imagined that HIV-positive men fucking without condoms would be likely to remain circumspect about publicizing their sexual behavior, then we misapprehend what makes barebacking the basis for a subculture. Unlike erotic activities such as masturbation, that elicit little or no representational trace, bareback sex seems to call for witnesses and thus to generate documentary evidence as well as communal bonds. I'm suggesting that barebackers are breeding not only a virus, but also a way of life, with its own distinct identities, rituals, and iconography. It is perhaps inevitable that a sexual subculture's self-representation should take the form of pornography. Yet despite the impulse to show it all and leave nothing merely implicit, pornography is a genre governed by conventions that regulate what may and may not be shown. When we consider porn as more than a provocation to sexual excitement, we find an array of visual and discursive conventions that even in this least inhibited of genres constrain the appearance of the unconventional. I'm particularly intrigued by how bareback porn, in its effort to make certain forms of intimacy visible, poses a challenge not just to pornographic conventions, but to representation as such. Aspiring to represent raw sex, bareback porn paradoxically adapts technologies of visual mediation, the digital camera, the internet, to its project of overcoming mediation. The principal problem confronting bareback porn is that the defining convention of film and video pornography, the money shot, remains at odds with the defining practice of the subculture. The problem is that bareback sex involves not just the absence of condoms, but also a commitment to internal ejaculation, the most dangerous act of all in the age of AIDS. Deliberately ingesting semen, a practice known in the subculture as cum swapping, bonds the men involved to each other and to a history of semen exchange that connects the living and the dead. In these terms, bareback sex without internal ejaculation would be meaningless. Hence the conundrum that defines bareback porn as a genre, since the visible evidence that is most wanted is precisely what cannot be achieved without compromising the subculture's values. A sexual subculture that relies on porn for its self-representation has to face the paradox that pornographic convention works against the faithful depiction of its central erotic practice. In making this argument, I'm simply following commentators on hardcore film and video pornography, who are virtually unanimous in characterizing the spectacle of male ejaculation, the money shot, as the most important element of the genre. Quote, "If you don't have the cum shots, you don't have a porno picture," insists Steven Ziplo in The Filmmaker's Guide to Pornography. Linda Williams, in her classic study of the genre, takes up this axiom to argue that hardcore pornography aspires not just to get its viewers off, but also to find out something. Motivated by the ambition to make everything visible and thus knowable, hardcore porn encounters problems when attempting to register definitive visual evidence of female orgasms. As Williams puts it, quote, "Seeing everything, especially seeing the truth of sex, proves a more difficult project than one might think, especially in the case of women's bodies, whose truths are most at stake." In her account, the spectacle of male ejaculation comes to substitute for what cannot be seen. Porn's ubiquitous money shots compensate its straight male viewers for the missing visual testimony of women's erotic pleasure. In the 17 years since it first appeared, Williams' analysis has been criticized for its heterosexism, for basing a conceptual model on straight porn and failing to take account of gay or lesbian porn. Yet her argument about the pornographic principle of maximum visibility holds good for mainstream gay porn too, as well as for its bareback variant. The genius of Williams' book lies in her dissociating the rise of cinematic porn from earlier traditions of sexually explicit representation and connecting it instead with modern discourses of sexuality that culminate in machines of the visible, a phrase she borrows from French film theorist Jean-Louis Camoli. It is not that a pre-existing pornographic imagination had to content itself with expression in writing and drawing until the 19th century invention of photography and subsequently cinema, but rather that these new technologies serve the larger cultural project of making sex visible. And in this way, they form part of the massive deployment of sexuality described by Foucault. Williams makes clear how the 19th century, quote-unquote, incitement to discourse, the imperative to speak about sex and produce knowledge about it, generated a correlative incitement to see that finds its technological apotheosis in cinema. Although bareback porn's documentary impulse conforms to the principle of maximum visibility, bareback subculture's erotic practices confound the pornographic imperative to produce money shots. One of the things that's most interesting, at least to me, about bareback porn is the generic innovations it undertakes to get around this contradiction. In what remains, I simply want to outline a kind of provisional typology of solutions to the genre's defining problem. Ejaculation has to be internal, therefore, how do you screen it? The first fairly common solution is what I call a compromise shot. In a compromise shot, the guy pulls out immediately before coming so that the camera can record his climax, but then quickly reinserts his penis to finish ejaculating inside. This technique, which calls for considerable discipline on the part of the man having an orgasm, it's sort of touching just to behold, offers a compromise between porn's demand for maximum visibility and the subculture's demand for internal ejaculation. The closer bareback porn approximates Paul Morris's documentary ideal, the fewer compromise shots are present. Besides resorting to the compromise shot, some Treasure Island movies have recourse to convention of the medium rarely seen in contemporary pornography, the subtitle. In a movie called Plant and Seed from 2004, a compilation tape Gloucester's What Men Do with Spooge Part 1, Morris employs the sort of intertitles that have been used to introduce porn scenes since the dawn of hardcore cinema. For example, Boning Billy Wilde. But he also employs frequent subtitles in a white font toward the bottom of the screen for two purposes. To make fully intelligible what's occurring on screen and to make fully audible what the participants are saying. Although shot professionally and in good light, the copulations unfolding in various locations before the viewer apparently offer insufficient visible evidence. The subtitles are meant to provide supplementary proof. For example, one category of subtitle consists in legends such as, quote, Jesse unloading inside Nick, and, quote, Jesse dumps another load, which signal the moment of internal ejaculation. Viewers are told explicitly what's happening in the scene when the conventional visual imagery, the money shot, is absent. In addition to subtitles describing action, Plant and Seed uses subtitles to confirm what the on-screen participants are saying. Often their words are audible, though indistinct. Now, most contemporary hardcore videos, especially those without plot or dialogue, that is, most contemporary porn, betray zero concern for the unscripted words their protagonists utter as they negotiate their sexual paces, preferring to substitute a generic musical soundtrack that is punctuated only by equally generic grunts and moans. Porn stars, like children, are meant to be seen and not heard. It is highly unusual to find a low-budget porn tape taking the trouble to ensure that its actors' unscripted words are not lost but actually emphasized. For example, during the scene alluded to above, in which the ornately tattooed Jesse pounds Nick, a character identified, and he's one of my favorites, on screen as Tom Sawyer, who is dressed in grubby overalls and a red baseball cap, encourages the action with audible but indistinct lines that appear as subtitles. Quote, Tom, yeah, and I could, in a different context, I would imitate this guy's accent, but in this context, I can't quite bring myself to do so. Talk to me privately, we'll arrange for me to imitate the accent. Tom, yeah, knock him up and feed me too. Knock him up and feed me too. Viewers familiar with the subculture will recognize this as a vernacular instruction for Jesse to ejaculate inside Nick and thereby provide Tom with an opportunity to eat semen out of Nick's butt. Yet the subtitles are doing more than preserving a subcultural vernacular. They are using verbal language to translate visual action into sense, thereby betraying the impotence of vision alone to capture raw sex. The audience sees subtitles rather than semen. Testimony substitutes for visible evidence. We could say that instead of the image of whitish fluid suddenly coming out of a penis, viewers are given in white lettering at the bottom of the screen a representation of something suddenly coming out of someone's mouth. Subtitles just thus constitute another kind of compromise shot. Porn shows us all manner of part objects entering the body, a penis, a tongue, a finger, a hand, a dildo, bodily fluids, a speculum, the eye of a camera, and it must show us what comes out, even if that amounts to little more than words. Given that it aims to capture what bodies release involuntarily, what they have to be coaxed into discharging, bareback porn exhibits its most distinctive version of the money shot, when all the quote-unquote loads that have been ejaculated inside a person come back out again. This spectacle is the reverse money shot that I've already described. The reverse money shot, and I have a little TM after that, it's like trademark, trademark phrase. I'm just kidding. The reverse money shot that begins Breed Me includes a close-up of the remarkable volume of seminal fluid collected in the measuring cup, but stops there. We are never shown what happens to all that ejaculate or the uses to which it might have been put. Subsequent offerings from this pornographer betray no such reticence. In the movie called Fucking Crazy, as later in Breed Me, there are various scenes of guys felching their own cum out of the bottom's ass. This is standard bareback porn fare. To say that Morris and his associates lack squeamishness would be to understate the case. In fact, they are connoisseurs of semen. Not content with ingesting seminal fluid the moment it's ejaculated, they specialize in devising uses for spooge that has been stored somewhere a while. Another variant of bareback porn's money shot consists in collecting semen from various sources, mixing it together, and then funneling it inside somebody at a later date. This is the bareback version of artificial insemination, being bred by men you've never met. We might call it the paradox of unlimited intimacy at a distance. This conceit animates the movie Plant and Seed, one of Paul Morris's recent videos. The sequence of gangbangs that composes the movie is punctuated by scenes of an expert cocksucker named Joey Summers blowing a series of anonymous men through a glory hole at Folsom Gulch, a notorious adult bookstore in San Francisco's South of Market neighborhood. I recommend it. Released the bookstore. Released in spring 2004, the season for seed sowing, Plant and Seed plays on the idea that semen can be used to grow things, an idea that was foreign to gay culture, before the development of an elaborate discourse surrounding HIV transmission. The video opens with a solo model ejaculating into a funnel apparently held by the cameraman. The funnel's presence suggests that this conventional money shot is to be enlisted in the project of defying pornographic convention by its representing not a conclusion but a beginning. As an initial deposit, it represents the mise-en-scène of a larger narrative that includes the subsequent, apparently unrelated scene, identified by subtitle as, quote, Joey Milks 2 at Folsom Gulch, San Francisco. Subsequent scenes subtitled Joey Milks 3 More and, quote, Joey Milks Another 4 confirm the impression that this probably is how Joey spends much of his time. The difference between what might be Joey's habitual practice and what is represented on screen, we all know people like this, The difference between what might be Joey's habitual practice, they're not at the talk, they're out doing it right now, and what is represented on screen lies in not only the presence of a camera, but also the fact that Joey doesn't swallow. Instead, he takes the men's ejaculate in his mouth and spits it into a Tupperware container that slowly accumulates seed. These scenes of Joey spitting out the fruits of his labor might be considered weaker versions of Bareback Porn's reverse money shot. The rationale behind this accumulation of seminal fluid is revealed in the video's concluding scene, where we are introduced to a handsome young man, identified via subtitle as, quote, Jonas, his first time taking seed, who has it all funneled into his rectum at the climax of the final gangbang. After several men have ejaculated inside Jonas, dressed and left, the blue plastic funnel that we saw in the opening scene and the Tupperware container observed earlier reappear, along with what looks like a standard hotel room wine glass. As Joey transfers the contents of his Tupperware bowl to the wine glass, we hear a voice off screen commenting, "Joey worked hard for that." The funnel is placed in Jonas's anus, and against a background of street noise that includes sirens wailing and a clock striking five, a remarkable volume of viscous fluid is poured into the funnel, from which it seeps slowly into his rectum. The next shot shows Joey using his fingers to milk the seminal fluid back out of Jonas's butt and into another man's mouth waiting below. Through aggregation and ingenuity, Plantin Seed has transformed the pornographic convention of discrete money shots into numerous transfers of fluid, what I call the multiple displaced money shot. Alluding to funneling, a drinking practice common in college fraternity subculture, whereby alcohol, you may have be familiar with this, whereby alcohol is siphoned directly into the esophagus via a funnel and tube to accelerate intoxication. This video evokes also the dynamics of initiation and competition that characterize membership in exclusively male groups, such as fraternities. Rituals of excessive ingestion enable homosocial bonding with men one might never have met. He acquires membership by undergoing what previous generations of brothers have undergone. In Plantin Seed, Jonas is inseminated with the ejaculate of men whom we have every reason to believe he's never encountered. The subtitle claiming that what we're witnessing is, quote, his first time taking seed, encourages us to view the funneling ritual as Jonas's initiation. And although he looks as though he could be a college student, the conceit of initiating a newbie, of deflowering a virgin, or capturing, quote unquote, the first time on film, is a well-established porn convention that dates back at least a Saad. But what if this really was Jonas's first time taking seed? What if he were HIV negative prior to these scenes in Plantin Seed? What might this video be documenting? Such concerns are compounded by the fact that we cannot be sure whether the men getting blown through the glory hole were aware either that their anonymous sex was being filmed or that their ejaculate was going to end up anywhere other than inside the guy blowing them. HIV is a weak virus that cannot live outside the body. Nevertheless, there is an ethical problem in appropriating men's semen without their knowledge or consent. Given the low risk associated with oral sex, a seropositive man in San Francisco might consent to an anonymous blowjob when he wouldn't consent to having his ejaculate transferred into a third party's rectum. The possibility that one's ejaculate might be used for unknown purposes, that something could be done with it about which he remains ignorant, conjures a sort of fantasy of alien abduction in which otherworldly beings extract human genetic material for sinister ends. Or perhaps this popular fantasy offers a narrative to explain a common masculine anxiety, namely that we cannot always be certain about the destiny of what we often so casually ejaculate. For gay men, this anxiety is intensified by the specter of HIV pervading our sexual cultures. Through the virus, our lives are intimately connected with men we've never even seen, not only those who may have slept with him, forgotten. The epidemic has shown how something that belongs to a complete stranger can get inside me permanently. Thus, the point of funneling and the multiple displaced money shot of planting seed may be less to document an actual initiation than to allegorize these complex relays of viral transmission, to picture how one can get something inside his body from some guy he's never met. Funneling may be bareback porn's way of dramatizing the sex ed dictum that each time you have sex with someone, you're having sex with all the people he's ever had sex with. They tell you this in high school. In other words, they're telling you that every time you have sex, it's a gangbang. Right? You're having sex with all the people that person has had sex with, too. If the pornographic bedroom tends toward overcrowding, multiple performers plus film crew, then the funneling scene that ends planting seed helps us to see how it is crowded with not only persons, but also ghosts, that is, the residual traces of persons. When the funnel is inserted into Jonas's anus, he simultaneously inserts himself into a secret history through an act of identification with gay men who have preceded him. One consequence of what might be called this ritual summoning of ghosts is that sexual action generates sexual community, irrespective of how crowded or empty the scene of this action might be. Ritualized bodily movement engenders a kind of impersonal identification with strangers past and present that does not depend on knowing, liking, or being like them. In other words, impersonal identification doesn't require one to imagine or believe in a shared identity. The implication is that certain sexual activities evoke history and community even when practiced alone. One of the accomplishments of bareback pornography, thus, would be its making visible a connection to gay history that has all but disappeared. If it cannot make the virus appear on screen, at least bareback porn can make apparent what it means to be part of an erotic history that the virus exploited without being able to destroy. Thank you. So I think now we're going to screen. I don't trust technology, so I say we're going to screen, but who knows what's going to come up. I think we're going to screen like that opening scene I described from Breed Me. I want you to see like the credits from this, in a sense, inaugural film of the genre. It has a countdown. How apropos. This is from 1999. Can you see? The warning that appears next, Paul Morris no longer puts it on his this. This is no longer included. Oh, that's 3 minutes. Okay. So, I mean, it ends with a close-up of the accumulated seminal fluid in the funnel or measuring cup. Like the first. This is something I didn't talk about in the paper because I wrote the paper before this film came out. It seemed to me interesting. It was another. Sort of invention of what to do, how to get a lot of semen into one place and then do something different with it. And this one, if you can fast forward. Can you go to the menu? Oh, it has to, okay. This second clip, I think, is the last we're going to show you for a while, so make the most of it. Oh. Oops. This is really hardcore. I don't know if you can bear to watch this. You won't play it? Well, I'll then just describe what I didn't describe in the paper, which is this is much more done much more aesthetically in a way that seems aesthetically conventional, pleasing. It's called like the making of the devil's dick, right? Where what you have is very sort of quick excerpts of various guys jacking off and coming into like little shot glasses, and they're numbered, and so you get 73 loads of cum. And they're all then poured into an extra large condom. And then you see this like this condom kind of like which is filmed very close up and kind of lit very interestingly. And it's like about to burst. And then they refrigerate it, right? So then it's like a popsicle, but a giant, the devil's dick is a giant popsicle made of cum. And then they use it to do various things. And the scene that I really wanted you to see, since it's sort of like, it's just amusing, they finally get it inside this guy's butt, and it's like it's frozen. It's like and they're like, oh, you've got 73 guys worth of cum in your ass, and then he torpedoes it back out, and it goes so fast that they're like in the corner of the screen is like one of those replays, like in a sports thing, where they do it in slow motion. They're like, there it goes. So it's sort of like, I don't know. I just found that very entertaining. And I thought you might too. But I guess we're not going to get to see it. Maybe we should. Do we. With that, I wanted to show the final scene. Can you get to the menu and choose which scene you're going to show? Oh, right. Well, maybe. Why don't we have a chat?
Wait, we can play some stuff after the panel? I might ask for something about okay, so we're going to just, maybe the panelists will just speak for a few minutes. I was just going to ask you a couple questions. Okay. All right. So just a couple of quick responses. But one thing that struck me just watching, I mean, many things struck me just watching that. But one of the things that struck me was that it seemed very, clinical, almost like a kind of medical, like something that would happen as a sort of day visit to the doctor. And so I wondered if along with sort of eroticizing risk, right, like what you can't do, it's also about sort of eroticizing a kind of medicalized interaction. That just, you know, with the measurement and the sort of, you know, the beakers and the funnels and all that. So that was just a thought. I was also kind of surprised by the music, which seems sort of goth and like a little even sort of melodramatic. So I wasn't really expecting that. I don't know if you had any thought about that. I was wondering also about all of the kind of pregnancy, breeding imagery, and I don't know, just to sort of think about, obviously from, you know, Bersani's classic essay about Is the Rectum a Grave, there's obviously been a sort of, you know, way of thinking about, you know, gay male anal sex in relation to sex with women or sex as a woman, but I wondered how, you know, I thought it was interesting what you said about, you know, seed is has been, you know, since the virus, thought of as something that can grow, that, you know, can grow something. Is that thing a baby, right? How much is that? And how does that maybe help us to rethink Bersani, I guess, or that sort of association? You know, is that, and that, it's sort of how it takes up a sort of particular history of what it, what kind of risks women run in unprotected sex, I guess. And then I just thought maybe, especially since intimacy is like the key term in your book, if you could try to talk about intimacy or community, like kind of, I guess, a little bit more how you're, like how you define those terms, I guess. Like what does intimacy with somebody you, you know, not only who's like a stranger you're having sex with, but like somebody you've never met, you know, it seems like there's a kind of network theory kind of intimacy there. So maybe you could just say a little something about that.
I don't know. Shall I answer all those questions right now?
Maybe we could just.
I think we're doing little comments.
I'll instead of collecting semen, I'll collect questions. I want 73 loads at least. Heather's just giving me 10. How many can you?
I'll get the funnel.
Can hold on to Heather's questions before I
ask
mine, or give you
more to think about. I just want to say that I think what's wonderful about the work that you're doing is that it can respond so even-handedly to what a raw response probably can't manage. I mean, that you can consider what is being represented here and turn it to an account of identifications and a connection to gay history that is not fatal, despite the suggestions that what is being risked here is death, is something I think we need to applaud. So I thank you for that, and I think we all do. I know that my own responses have been very much compromised by having to watch these things with only a pen in hand, and have taken multiple notes, and it's a curious way of responding to this kind of thing. I think there are maybe three separate topics that I especially want to explore, and I will just throw them out to you, and you can pick up whatever one you want. One has to do with identification and how this kind of pornography may change what usually pornography solicits in the way of identification between the viewer and the person's being represented. At one point, you say about Breed Me, this scene inhibits identification rather than solicits it. And this is a very odd thing for pornography to do. And it's a very odd thing to do as a way then of getting to more identifications rather than less, in as much as more and more reception of semen seems to suggest more and more inter-identifications among the participants who are being dramatized or represented. I think the question of identification has a lot to do with whether or not the subject, the viewer subject, is being addressed as an active viewer in relation to the persons on screen who seem to be especially receptive, but I wonder if the receptivity is not actually a displacement of activity in a way that that deserves talking about. How actually is reception showing signs of not being tolerated because the receivers are so active in receiving, so that they seem to be turning the tables on receptivity at the very moment reception is being portrayed and intensely portrayed. Then I'd love to have you talk about the Americanness of these films, because Tom Sawyer is only one specimen of how these films are saturated in popular American culture and also in either American realities about egalitarianism or American fantasies about egalitarianism. I mean, in a certain way, the film called Fucking Crazy suggests to me that democracy is fucking crazy. sexual democracy is fucking crazy. And finally, the documentary claim. Are we really seeing documentary? Paul Morris is quoted as a devotee of honest representation. I think there are lots of reasons to doubt that. And the unanswered questions, the unasked questions in Fucking Crazy are not signs of honesty, because one of the unasked questions, especially of the star of the show, Max Holden, is, are you HIV negative or positive? Are these people HIV negative or positive? There's nothing, if all of these people are positive, there's nothing dangerous being shown. If all of them are negative, there's nothing risky being shown. But why does the filmmaker, who is so big on honesty, not tell us about their HIV status?
Okay, yes, I just say a few things. And I first say that prior to this, I'd read a wonderful book that Tim has written that's really a systematic analysis of this culture. But I hadn't seen the images. And I've just discovered them a few weeks ago. And I was imagining, as we were watching the 3 long minutes, the introduction of the innocent neighbor who just come, open the door, and see all of us watching this strange butthole. And then I thought that this would be the beginning of another pornographic film, because it's a cliche of pornography that some sexual acts are being performed, and you have the mailman or the milkman or the neighbor who enters, and of course immediately he starts getting into play. And I was wondering what kind of, you know, reflection would this innocent person have? What are we all doing here, watching this, talking about this, looking quite serious, academic, and I was thinking of this. What seems to be one of the core notions of pornography, this idea that it is real. And Serge Leclerc mentioned this in one analysis of a patient who likes pornography just because it is real. And of course, the culmination of that real reality effect is the cum shot. But in this case, what we see is a curious excess of the cum shot that is taken at a second degree, as it were, and is brought to streams of cum and semen, really, as this kind of material substance that is everywhere. And you don't know what to do with it. So there's something almost clinical, almost religious in that transmission of the sacred fluid. There's indeed, I don't want to shock anybody, but something like a strange transmutation of semen into, well, life or death, clearly. And that's the last point I'd like to make, reading your book, which is both, let's say, critical analysis and empathic understanding from within of this strange subculture, what you show very well is that it's Derrida's theory on the gift with a vengeance.
Right.
That is, there's the only one gift that is possible, and it's the gift of death. The ultimate gift is the gift of death, because any other gift is just impossible. So just wanted to say that. I don't know whether you want to respond to all of this.
Yes, my goodness. This is... I do feel overwhelmed with totally interesting comments and questions, and I'm not sure quite in what order to take them. I mean, maybe... One way to get at these various kinds of questions is to talk about the film which Robert was referring to, this movie Fucking Crazy, which maybe we will screen at the end, which enables me to actually answer a number of these questions. That is a film made by Paul Morris's studio in San Francisco, and is advertised explicitly as a documentary. That is to say... They simply added a camera in. Of course, we're never simply added a camera in. They simply added a camera in to an organized, regular sex party that occurs every month in San Francisco. You can find it online. What is it called? Cute Boy Bareback Gangbang San Francisco. If you put that into Google, you will find the website. And the way, and what's one of the things that's interesting about that organization is just how many rules. It's highly rule-bound. One person takes the role of bottom, and then you apply to be a top to come and fuck this guy. And then this person, Max Holden, whom Robert referred to, you know, the story goes, called up Paul Morris and said, you know, I'm going to be the bottom at this regularly scheduled gangbang. Why don't you come and make a film about it? Right? And so that's sort of what happens. And one of the things, and there's a number of, you know, and I blather on about this at great length in my book, one of the things that's interesting to me is the range, the kind of demographic range of people who are tops in this film. That is to say, you know, in other words, any one of us, any guy here could be in the film. Right. This is one of the things that's sort of interesting about Paul Morris's movies. One of the things that I think is going on in that film and in the subculture in general, this is sort of responding to Jean-Michel's point about the neighbor who is drawn in, or that is to say the kind of innocent observer who sort of observes and then is sort of drawn in, seduced into the action, which is kind of, as you say, a kind of trope of pornography. I think the gangbang is a sort of the paradigmatic form that sex in this subculture takes, because you already then have witnesses there, right? In other words, there's a bunch of guys standing around, the witnesses there. What you see in the documentary Fucking Crazy is you see the guys who are part of the gangbang as witnesses. You see the photographer, and the photographers themselves are sort of, you know, participate in the action too, get drawn into the action. You see then the kind of, like, you know, how to say it, not very attractive middle-aged men whose apartment this is taking place in, occasionally, like, taking, you know, they strain to the shot and take little pictures. And so there's a kind of like a concentric circle of witnesses. Of course, as soon as this is marketed as pornography or put on the web, you have another set of witnesses, a kind of radiating circle of witnesses to this ritual. And I think that part of what goes on in the subculture is an attempt to overcome the distinction between witnesses and participants, or that is to say, make witnesses into participants, right? Which is a sort of interesting instance of multiplication or breeding of subcultural participants. So that's sort of one point. Another point to maybe make, you know, one of the rules with these parties is that only one person can be the bottom, right? And so therefore everybody else has to take the role of a top. No matter what you prefer to do in your ordinary life, you have to be a top. And you have to come inside of the guy, right? In other words, whatever your HIV status, whatever his HIV status, you're obliged, you sort of sign a form. This is part of the criteria for showing up. You have to come inside of the guy. And also then there's this element of competition, which I think is part of what makes these things extremely American. Who can take the most loads? That's basically the thing underlying these parties, right? And there's on the website, if you see, there's loads of fame gallery, which hierarchizes the guys at the party who've taken the most loads. So you have to kind of compete. How many loads? How much stuff can you get inside of yourself? Which has to do with multiplication. There's a sort of interesting logic of counting and adding it within the subculture, particularly within these films. And so you have Dawson, who's one of the stars who we have not talked about. I think Dawson is Aaron's favorite. When I called Aaron and said, I'm sending you some movies, he's like, do they contain Dawson? Dawson's everyone's favorite, but including Aaron's. There's the movie called Dawson's 20 Load Weekend. Then the next movie is Dawson's 50 Load Weekend. And the last time I checked online, at treasureislandmedia.com, there is an advertisement. We are doing Dawson's 100 Load Weekend. If you are just an ordinary guy who wants to come and fuck Dawson and come inside of him for this, be one of the 100. You sign up here and you do sign up there, right? So part of this is also a way of saying that these things are staged, but they are also rituals that are documented. Obviously, if those of us who are sort of academics and think about theories of representation or film know that, a documentary is never simply, there just happens to be a camera there. It's obviously staged, and there's a whole set of conventions. But one of the things that I do think, Paul Morris films are not like your standard pornography where, there just happens, it's like there's the illusion of you being a voyeur, but everything's staged. These are actually Paul Morris attempting to document what guys are doing. At the same time, the fact that he's doing that means that guys go to him and say, I want you to document this. One of the things he's talked about is a lot of guys have gone to him and said, I'm HIV negative, I found the guy who's going to seroconvert me, who's going to infect me, and I want it recorded on film, right? Now, to me, this is highly analogous to having one's wedding videotaped or whatever, right? In other words, it's a meaningful kinship ritual that people are going through that they won't record it on film. Now, he makes the point that, to even do that puts him in a felonious position, right? In other words, the deliberate transmission of HIV is a felony, a class A felony in most states, right? I think that, in a sense, is the answer to the question of why nobody's HIV status is ever revealed in these movies explicitly, right? Because you have to, in order not to be prosecuted under that legislation, you have to maintain the deniability, right? In other words, all of these parties that one can go to, these events that one can participate in, you have to sign, disclaimer, disclosure forms, not just like model releases, but forms sort of saying that you won't talk about your HIV status, that you agree not to talk about it, and also that, you assume that everybody there is HIV positive. Right. In other words, you assume that everybody in the room is HIV positive. And I think in a lot of these films, that assumption is made, both on the part of the viewers. I can't say what viewers assume. I think the participants assume that everybody involved is HIV negative. And therefore, it's very interesting what the whole rhetoric of breeding is about. And this is sort of going back to one of the things that Heather asked. I've been working on this stuff for a while, thinking about it for a while, but to me, there's something that remains a residual enigmatic dimension of what do they mean by breed? I feel like sometimes, am I missing something? Am I just being stupid? Or what level of resistance is there in me that I cannot quite get exactly? what breeding means. Sometimes it just seems to mean to ejaculate inside of somebody. Sometimes it seems to have a more loaded connotation, like transmitting the virus or like breeding the virus. Sometimes it seems to be breeding as in, you know, breeding the subculture, right? It's certainly, this again goes back to what Heather was asking, something about creating networks and links. Even if they're with people you don't know, it's very important. In other words, there's a kind of impersonal relationality, one of the ways I try to talk about it is in terms of kinship. You know, the model that I try to use, simply because it's the part of the vocabulary that comes from the subculture, is the language of kinship, right? And of becoming either the parent or the child or the recipient of somebody's gift. Somebody's gift. What else did I want to say? Oh, one of the other things to say, you know, and we've shown Paul Morris, well, we haven't shown that much yet. I've talked about Paul Morris movies. I do think that he's a sort of I think he's both a documentary filmmaker in some way and also an avant-garde filmmaker. He reads Leo Bassani, and he's self-taught, but he's read Bassani. Right. He's read Is the Rector McGrave. And so he sort of is interestingly well-informed. You just know that, like, most people in the San Fernando Valley have never heard of Leo Bassani, right? Paul Morris actually has. One of the things that interests me is how the virus has become sort of overdetermined and multiply coded as something that one can do something with. You know, part of my book is called How to Do Things with HIV, right? The gay men have conducting these unregulated experiments with the virus, and much of this is sort of phantasmatic. Nevertheless, there is a real virus involved. That is, how does one create links to people by transmitting the virus to them? How does one create family networks or kinship structures through the virus? How does one actually build something from this virus, which for the longest time was thought of as simply fatal, right? That is, it could only destroy, it could only kill. What fascinates me about this, about the kind of emergence of this subculture, not out of nowhere, but in a way that seems to me somewhat unpredictable that it should have emerged, is this idea that, in fact, the virus can be used creatively. And the thing I find interesting about the films is the way in which they're creative or inventive with the conventions of porn. I feel like I'm completely rambling. I've had so much cough medicine, I'm kind of rambling. I'm sort of vaguely alluding to these very interesting questions.
Maybe a question.
Questions from the audience? Or?
We can, sure.
Maybe just to go back to what you were saying about this idea that having sex with a partner is having sex with all his partners.
Right.
It's a medieval and Renaissance idea, which was used to condemn Anne Boleyn to be executed. Mm-hmm. And she was accused of incest because she had sex with somebody else who had sex with. So isn't there something like a return in the name of the medical science and what we know about HIV viruses and so on, to a sort of medieval or almost magical thinking about sex as being the locus of an exchange?
Right. No, I think there is. I mean, I think there's various forms of return. And I think that thinking about the virus explicitly as a gift and talking about transmitting the virus as gift-giving, anthropologically, gift-giving is the way you form societies, the way you form communities. You know, it's a kind of very old means of creating solidarity relations between persons or groups. And what fascinates me is the way this sort of discourse of gift-giving has emerged in a way which seems like, you know, it seems like a, you know, I use the word in scare quotes, I still hesitate to use it, but a very kind of primitive mode of cultural formation. that this has been sort of produced within the subculture, within this, you know, subculture, which is, you know, as far as I know, as far as my research has been able to determine, sort of originated in San Francisco, right? And therefore, in various kinds of ways, seems to be a particularly American subculture. It is now, thanks to the internet, spread, you know, spread definitely to Europe. And if you go to London or you go to Berlin, there are big, you know, bareback subcultural networks. But it began, I think, in San Francisco, which is where Paul Morris is located. And it seems to me there is something quintessentially American about the subculture, and doubtless about the films, too. That is to say, it seems to me that it's within a North American, or particularly U.S., culture that sort of, you know, the medical and scientific community fetishized the virus to start with. Before gay men started fetishizing the virus, the medical community fetishized the virus in a way that was different from other parts of the world, I think. Therefore, it's not surprising then that fetishization of the virus would come into gay culture too, and would be sort of just simply flipped around or transvalued in some way.
Tim, can I just to pressure you a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Because gift giving sounds good.
Benign.
And sounds like a form of exchange that's pre-capitalist. And so would be an alternative to capitalist economies. But while I was watching this, I was thinking, is this a gift economy or commodity trading? Mm-hmm. Is it commodity trading with insider trading at the same time? I was thinking, you know, what would be a euphemism for felching? Insider trading. And I wonder, gift giving, I think, accepts waste, right? The structure of gift giving is actually a structure that is about not saving. It's generous. Now, what happens here is that there's a tremendous saving. Everything gets saved.
Boarding, right.
And not only does every drop of semen get saved, but it's recirculated for consumption. Mm-hmm. So that it's total consumption, and there's no waste, no loss. And that strikes me as at odds with the gift model, which is why I'm thinking that it's peculiarly American, at least as of this moment. I mean, I think with the receivers becoming the celebrities in the commodification of exchange.
Right. I think there's a kind of tension here, because one of the things to note is that, you know, even in, you know, even in the non-Western cultures in which anthropologists develop theories of gift giving is also conceived as an aggressive thing, as a competitive thing, right? The potlatch is it's not simply benign. It's like you're fucking somebody up by giving them so much stuff, right? And I also think that, you know, the semen exchange and all these transfers of fluid and semen that I talked about, but there's also, obviously, there's the gift that can't be returned, right? There's the gift that, in a sense, only goes one way, right? In other words, the gift of, the quote-unquote gift of seroconversion can't be returned in the same way, right? That's a sort of a one-time gift or a one-time event. And I think that's, in that sense, it's sort of, conforms to a logic of the gift that is separate from a capitalist model, even as there's all this sort of, sense of accumulation, competition about loads, and kind of, you know, circulation through an economy of this bloop, you know. So I think there's several things going on, I guess.
Okay, I think we have time for a few questions before we show some more footage. So. Does anybody have questions they'd like to ask? Comments? Yeah.
I want to come back to the multiplication and addition. You yourself in describing this film, keeping track, count 16, 20, 73, I remember these
numbers appear on screen, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, and I think, I mean, obviously, Paul Morris, who's never been to college, but he's very, you know, well-read, I'm sure his porn is quite, you know, interestingly elusive. You know, if we showed you more, if we had more time or more, whatever, patience, whatever, or something, I'm not sure it's patience that's required, one could see the kinds of, you know, the kinds of... visual, and as you say, the kind of literary pornographic tradition that's being alluded to. Yeah, no, I think that's useful to note. I just want those of you who are in the English department of Penn to note that your chair alluded to daisy chaining. File that away. File that away.
Richard.
Sure.
Yep.
Right. But I'm curious about, like, probably this audience is not the audience that was predicting.
Sure.
And so I'm really interested, I mean, truly interested and impressed by the idea of rerouting these representations to a different audience. I mean, and I take it that's one of the things your book is trying to do. And we could think of that academic audience as also a kind of subculture. That has overlaps, obviously, with gay male subcultures, but is also quite distinct from them. So I just was interested in what it means to propose this as avant-garde and as a theoretical text, I guess, on somehow the dialogue on par with the other.
Sure. No, I think that's that question gets at something really fundamental about the project, I think. I mean, I invoke Bassani just because, you know, Heather asked it as a question, and it reminded me when Heather mentioned it, just that, you know, Morris alludes to, you know, on the website somewhere, something about Bassani, and it's sort of, you know, one is not used on porn websites to seeing allusions to Bassani or to, you know, any of the kind of work, say, that we do. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, doesn't matter to me. I suppose part of what I'm trying to do in saying that I think he's an avant-garde pornographer is to make additional claims about the work, right? In other words, you know, it would be possible. You know, there's a lot of studios producing bareback porn, but it just doesn't seem to me especially interesting. You know, that is to say, the guys don't wear rubbers, but it's, apart from that, it's not that distinguishable from other kinds of pornography. What interests me about Morrison is all the ways in which it is distinguishable from other kinds of pornography, although it's, as you say, it's not meant for, like, this kind of an audience. I think, you know, if Paul Morris were here, I think he would have totally interesting things to say, you know. And maybe, you know, next time you can have him. You know, he's a very smart, articulate man. The question about, okay, what kind of audience, how does sort of writing about this or thinking about it within an academic context, what does that do, I think is a very good question. It's a hard question for me to answer. You know, I started writing this book, you know, let's put it like this. I started doing what I now call research, but I didn't think of it as going as research. I just thought of it as having sex. I also think about things. And so I started writing about it, but it wasn't clear to me that I was going to publish anything. You know, and I thought, well, maybe I can write like 20 pages about this, and maybe some obscure journal will publish it, and it won't do my career any damage. And then I discovered that I actually had a lot to say, you know, and that in fact I had a book worth of stuff to say. And it's like, you know, and I said this at the event earlier at Penn, it's like one of the things that I think is great about the institution of tenure is that it does give you the freedom to write about whatever you want. And I suppose I kind of embrace that, you know. And it was not clear to me, you know, when I was being promoted last year, nobody had read any part of this book. I didn't show it to anybody. I haven't published any part of it. And then I'm using it as a book to get promoted on, which means that all my colleagues at Buffalo now have to find out what Tim has been working on for the past few years. And it was not clear to me how that was going to go, you know. My hope was that, that they actually wouldn't read it. It's like another book, okay, fine, he can be promoted. You know, that was sort of my hope. And I can tell certain colleagues have read it. They wipe their hand after they shake my hand. None of them has really talked to me about it. So in other words, this is partly saying, like, you know, this is a way of saying, like, I actually don't know what I'm doing. But I think it's a really, I think it's a real question. Yeah. So thank you.
So we can take one more question. Brandon?
I was just wondering, you said although the status, the HIV status of the actors is not known, at least in a lot of these films, the characters look incredibly healthy, whether it's Dawson or
right.
The other characters are muscular. And it does seem to suggest that even if there is infection, there is life after infection.
Sure.
Which points to issues of access. And I wonder, with this community you're talking about, how limited is that community when it comes to access?
Right. Now that's a good question. I'm glad you asked, because somebody always asked that question, and nobody had asked it yet, so I'm very glad you asked that question. Sure. The question, shall I stand up?
Bad idea.
The question was about access to the drugs that enable this culture, subculture, to kind of exist. You know, and is it Brandon was saying, you know, a lot of the actors in these films look perfectly healthy, you know, in the words, there's life after infection, right? I have several things to say about that. One of them is that obviously, you know, there is a medical and pharmacological substrate that enables a condition of possibility for the existence of the subculture. Part of what's interesting, though, is that some of the people in the subculture do not have medical insurance, right? That is, they don't have access to the drugs, and yet, nevertheless, they are, quote-unquote, bug-chasing, right? So in other words, you read in the media about this, they say, well, people that have these drugs available, these people are young, they don't know any better, they think the drugs will enable them to live forever. That's, I think, actually a misunderstanding or mischaracterization of what's going on in the subculture. You know, one of the things that's interesting seeing the movie Fucking Crazy is that a lot of the guys don't look that well, actually. That is to say, they look like they've been on the cocktails for a long time. Some of them are extremely skinny. Some of them just look basically sick. And what's interesting is therefore to have porn in which you have like the top looking like this person is sick, and he's fucking a guy and he's coming inside of him. That is to say, one cannot then deny, you know, this is an HIV positive guy on top ejaculating inside of somebody. When I sort of think about these movies as quote-unquote democratic, the Paul Morris ones in particular, what I find interesting is that there's, in a sense, almost no physiological criteria, no aesthetic criteria for being in the movies. That's why I say quite confidently that sort of anybody in the room could be in one, right? In which you don't have to be handsome or have a big dick or, you know, go to the gym every day in order to be in one of these movies. You just have to be prepared to participate. And that, I think, is very interesting because, and I think it's sort of a response that seems to me politically interesting to the kind of, you know, hyper-policing of the kind of bodies that usually are allowed to appear in pornography. So in other words, I think that, you know, a broader range of people have access to the subculture, to participating in the subculture and in the films. But that doesn't necessarily give them access to the medications. And some of the people don't have access to those medications.
Janet.
Yes, Janet.
I just have to put the disability word into the
sure. Right. No, I mean, I think you're right, and one of the things that does interest me is, like I say, the kind of real expansion of the range of bodies that can be considered sort of eligible for appearance in a pornographic film, and that can be considered both, you know, as I said earlier, both subjects and objects of desire. You know, there's a movie produced by Dick Ward Media, which is the other big, interesting bareback porn producer called Stump, which I haven't actually written about, but I'm very interested in. It involves a guy with a stump. You can imagine what goes on. And it seems, and you know, that may be a movie where like the stump is a kind of fetish object, right? And one would want to make a critique of the fetishization of the of a certain kind of disabled body. What I find interesting about Paul Morris is the kind of expansion of what's considered sort of erotic, you know, without necessarily having to fetishize certain kinds of difference. You know, I mean, that what's useful to screen about the long 3 minutes is like, you know, that's like, you know, if, to be in an ordinary film, like, poor movie, that guy would have to like shave those hairs off his ass and go to the gym and start tanning, right?
How about some evidence of pleasure? How about that? You know? What's an idea?
Right. Right. Presumably what you're seeing is the evidence of pleasure, right? You're seeing the evidence.
Okay, so I think we're going to wrap up the discussion now and show some clips. So if people you know, want to stay around for that, that's good. Or you know, you could leave now too. but for now, let's
You've
just please please thank Tim Dean for
well,
this
thank
great
you.
Presentation.
Thank you.
So are you excited about tonight?
Hell yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you expect it to be like?
I hope it's tons of hot guys with huge dicks.
Huge dicks.
Actually.
Yeah.
Big loads.
Oh, look at your butt.
Yeah, you like that? Hopefully you don't like that too.
You got one of the best butts I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Jeez. Do you know how many guys to expect?
I think he told me he had 20.
20 so, guys? What's going to happen?
But we'll see who really shows up. Because I think a lot of times not everybody ends up showing up.
Yeah.
I can originally say.
What's going to happen?
What's going to happen? That's an interesting part. Hey, follow me. I'm going to dress to come on. Okay, what's going to happen? I'll be on the bed, and then they'll all come in, and they just take turns fucking me and coming. Whether I can think the rules, they either have to come in my ass or my mouth, and they can't really fuck around with each other.
Have you ever met him before?
I'm not sure, because the person who hosts the party, he never tells you who's actually going to really be there.
So you don't know whether you've been with any of these
guys
before?
I imagine. I'll see familiar faces.
So you're hoping for, of course, hot guys, big dicks.
Yeah,
does it really,
a few pleasant surprises.
A few pleasant surprises.
Yeah.
Does it really matter, though?
Does why it really matter?
The dick size?
You know what? It's not always an indication of the best fuck, but when you're looking around, I always focus on the big ones first. The ones I want. So, but then the funny thing is, because I've done this gangbang business before, some people that aren't as big, it surprises you because they're good fuckers.
Tell me about the first one. I mean, after the first one gets so lucky and primes your hole, are you now in heat? You just...
Oh, yeah. Well, totally... I'm the kind of person that as soon as someone comes in my ass, I'm like 10 times hornier than when I started. So I can be like the horniest thing there, and as soon as somebody shoots in my asshole, I'm out of control.
What's it like getting fucked after you've got a load up there?
Like I said, I guess it just gets more intense just because I'm that much more horny and into what's going on.
What about guys who have smaller cocks after a larger cock's been up you and worked you open? Can you feel it?
You know what? The really funny thing about that is that people always tell me that, like, why I don't want to fuck you if you just had all those big dicks. But actually, a lot of times, like, say I use a big dildo on myself, the person's dick actually feels bigger after that happens. So if I had like a huge dildo up my ass and someone fucks me right away, their dick actually feels bigger. It's like more sensitive.
Because you're more sensitive.
Yeah, yes.
So you can still feel it.
But a lot of people, tops, whoever's fucking at the moment, they're a little intimidated and they think if you already had something huge, they're not going to measure up.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm sure.
And the same is true there. But I think it's just a psychological thing.
Do you think they overcompensate? The guys that are smaller, that are fucking afterwards, you know,
they might.
By fucking too hard?
They might. Actually, it's interesting because I just talked to somebody who said that he was at the last party like this and there were two guys there with huge dicks. And he said that it made him feel insecure and he didn't even want to fuck the person anymore because he felt like that same thing. Like, okay, they just took those two dicks, so why the hell do they want our little dicks?
Yeah.
And he got the general impression that a lot of the guys there sort of felt the same way. Which is interesting because I never thought about that.
It is interesting.
So...
what's it like to feel to feel a guy explode inside of you? Can you actually feel it?
I think actually to actually feel the cum hit you inside of there, no.
It's not warmer. Can you feel the pulsation?
It might be, yeah, and you can feel like when they, you know, when they cum, they tend to jerk and all the rest of that stuff. But I like to use like my butt muscle to kind of like suck the cum out.
Oh yeah,
and that they're always surprised by.
Do you mind if they wear a rubber?
No. I mean, personal preference is no rubber. Because at this thing, I mean, it's just about getting fucked and getting the loads. But on my private life, I like to, like, suck somebody's dick after it's been up my ass. So
that was my next question.
With a condom, I do it, but they taste terrible. So you kind of have to get over that. And with a condom, you're more likely to have to use lube. And I'm an anti-lube person. I just like spit. So between a condom and lube, you're... much going up the wrong street. But
is there a cock out there that you just can't take?
not yet. I'm not going to sit here and say I've had like cock in the foot, but...
What's it like preparing to get fucked? Like, how long did it take you to get ready today?
Well, different times, different things. So today, I'm not really sure all told because I kind of worked on it for a while. But sometimes it can take a long time. I mean, if you're conscientious bottom, you really don't want to be dirty. It's actually a lot of work.
You use a hose?
No, I use like a bulb type enema.
And that works? It gets in there? It
works for me, but I guess I just spend.
You spend a lot of time.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I tried like the bag thing, and I've actually never had a hose. I've used it at people's houses, but I don't know. I always wish I knew there was a trick, and I wish I knew there was a way you could tell you're 100% clean, but as far as I know.
Yeah, there's that second sphincter up there that
there's
just
not a way of knowing.
Is it a fun ritual, getting ready, or is it just a real pain in the ass?
I wouldn't say it's a fun ritual, but it's not really... It can be a pain in the ass, but the thing I don't really like about it is sometimes I can't be as spontaneous because I don't want to be dirty.
Sure.
When someone fucks me, so...
Sure.
My mind gets to working.
What do you do with the cum after it's inside of you? I mean, do you douche it out, or do you just, like, let it drip
down
your leg?
Actually, my favorite thing to do is, and it would seem... People would probably think it's funny... I'd like to leave and then still go get fucked by some accounts or more people.
That's not funny.
Getting my shoes. So.
That's not funny.
But some people might think, oh, you know, your ass has got to be so sore. Never.
Never.
No. So then if they'll fuck me with all that cum, then it's like dripping down your legs and it's, when you suck their dick, it's all over their dick and then...
And you can taste it.
Uh-huh. And then a lot of times in the end, I'll squirt it out of my ass and eat it myself. So
at that time or later? Later, when you're,
later.
When you're jacking off by yourself or
yeah,
something?
Last time I kept it all night long.
Yeah.
So
do you like
horniness starts over again.
Do you like having guys felchy it out?
Yeah, actually I do. If they're willing to do it, so yeah.
How old were you when you first got fucked?
Oh, I think I was 2021.
Is it?
I guess I'm a late bloomer.
Wow.
I'm making up for it. Yeah, I was never, you know, I wasn't one of those guys who was like getting fucked by my best friend next door and all that. So.
Is getting fucked just once enough? If it's really good?
Once by the one person?
Yeah, the one good hot fuck?
Yeah.
Can be enough?
It can be. A lot of times it's not.
So is one load enough or do you always want more?
Not always, but like I said, usually it just gets me thinking about more.
So you are satisfied sometimes?
Yeah. Of course.
So is it more about quality or quantity?
And a thing like tonight, it's quantity. Because I don't... I'm not picking the people, so it's definitely not quality. Or by my quality, because whoever... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not every guy there, I didn't handpick them, so they might not be like the hottest thing to me. So,
what makes you insatiable?
It's more quantity tonight than quality. If it's quality, that's what I mean—a pleasant surprise.
It would be nice if it was quantity of quality.
Right. I mean, that's like the ultimate fantasy, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it
like
is.
For me, if they were all black and Latin and had huge uncut dicks, I'd be dead.
This is a fantasy that so few get to live up to.
I know. That's one of the best, you know, it was a really hard decision for me to decide whether or not I was going to jump off that boat from fantasy to reality, and I'm glad I did, but it was a hard decision.
Do you mind if a guy messes with your cock when he's going to fucking you? Mm-mm. If he jerks you off, you don't mind that?
No, but at the same time, when I'm getting fucked, it doesn't really matter to me.
What's it like?
I kind of put my own dick on hold.
What about if you don't have a hard on yourself? Does it feel different?
No.
So
that's the thing I think sometimes people perceive that you're not really excited, but that's not true.
Yeah, well, also, it supposedly feels more sensitive if you're not erect.
Oh, yeah, that I didn't know.
No?
Uh-uh.
Hmm.
I know some
and
people,
also
they,
after
want, you, they want you to get hard.
Can you get fucked after you come?
That's the downside. Me, not really.
Yeah, you just got to hold it.
It's sort of like the pig in me goes to sleep. So.
Do you go into the situation with any expectations?
Yeah, just to, I don't know, not common sense, but I just put, like, my some parts of me away so that I can just be a complete total slut. I just let go. So there aren't very many opportunities in life to get to do that either.
What makes this hot for you?
What makes it hot?
Yeah.
Probably, you know, I think the hottest thing is thinking about it before it happens.
Yeah.
And then when you're there, it's hot just because, you know, like one guy just after the next just goes up your ass and just fucks you. It's like, I just get off on that.
Why do you do it?
Why do I do it?
It's because you get off on it?
Yeah, and it's a, like you said, it's a fantasy come true.
It's a fantasy come true.
Yeah,
completely.
You get off all these times thinking about it.
So you don't feel hot. You don't feel degraded?
Me personally, no.
Do you feel in power?
I don't know. You know what? I just feel like I'm... I don't think of it in those terms. I just feel that I'm honoring or I'm actually living out something that I've spent a lot of time fantasizing about. And I just, like I said, a tough decision. I decided to do it. And I get to live something. However people judge me or think of me is not important at this point. There are times in my life where that would have kept me from doing it. But now it's either you like me for who I am and this is a part of me, and if you don't, then move along.
Well,
you'd actually be surprised how many people, when it comes down to it, get off on that.
Oh, yeah. Should read our emails.
A lot of them pretend not, but...
Well, I think we should go have you live it up, because
all right.
It's time to go.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, take care.